Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran and I were still happy. We spoke to each other 2 minutes ago at the end of our interview, and our interview was about football kits, Kieran. So how excited were we?
It's better than Easter, it's better than Christmas when it comes to football kits, as far as I'm concerned.
The discussion was with a chap called John Blair, who's written a fantastic book called A Culture of Kits, The Definitive Guide to Classic Football Shirt Collecting. And this is what John had to say. John, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you here. Your book is a thing of beauty, although I do have the slight hump with you already, in that normally if we're interviewing politicians or CEOs of football clubs, I'll dash a couple of questions off on the back of a postcard. With you, it's been a 2-day job. Football kits, Kieran and I, just, oh my God. I've narrowed it down to about 45, and then I've narrowed that down to about 15. So hopefully we won't be here too long. But before we talk about the collecting and the valuing of football kits, John, just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, where you're from, who you support, what you do.
Yeah, so I'm from Scotland originally, been living out in the US for about 12 years now, working in finance for an investment bank, and Manchester United fan, as well as Scotland for the last 30 years.
Well, you work in America, you're from Scotland, of course you support Manchester United. There's no other team you would support, John, is there? John, some people, like Kieran, collect shirts, but you collect shirts. I mean, you're part of a global community who collect and trade in these things. Where did this passion come from?
Yeah, there's a few parts of that. I mean, I feel pretty lucky to have been kind of born at a time when football content was becoming much more readily available. So the early 90s, the launch of the Premier League, the new format Champions League, and then more accessibly Football Italia on Channel 4 really kind of gave kids of my generation a chance to see those players, those games, those shirts at an early age. And so for a number of people, myself included, we attach an emotional attachment to those kits and those moments. And so creating a physical reminder of it through a shirt is something that there's a whole community around. And so that's part of it. The other part is, you know, being a typical tight Scotsman, I don't throw out anything. And so I've still got my original kits from age 10 onwards. And as I started to see the community expand, I started to showcase some of my kits on social media, and it just really went from there.
And is it because you love football, John, or because you just like trading things in general that you got into selling and buying shirts?
No, definitely a big love of football. I mean, I've been going to games from a really young age, and season ticket holder at Man United when I lived in the UK. Currently, season ticket holder at Real Salt Lake in the MLS. Very different vibe over there, but just love the game and attending live matches. And so, yeah, that's a big part of it.
It's interesting, John. I was actually going to ask you this question, but you've already sort of mentioned it. You talk about your generation, because it seems to me that the industry, for want of a better word, is driven mainly by 80s and 90s shirts. Is that entirely down to the fact that most of the people buying and collecting shirts are of your generation? Comics are a generation below me, like Josh Whittaker, for example, obsessed with football, but you know, the 60s and 70s feature less in their collections than the 80s and 90s do.
Yeah, and there's a few different parts to that. I mean, first of all, if you think of the supply of shirts in the 90s, that's really when they became mass-produced and available for people to buy, and so there's more of them, so that's the first part. The second part is there's a theory that people of my kind of age range, call it 30 to maybe late 40s, they're in a position of power within their companies, whether that's in the media, creating podcasts, magazines, social content. Josh is an example, obviously. And so they're the prominent voice, and so they're really kind of dictating what's fashionable and what's appealing to people, and so there's a lot of that going on. I do think it is cyclical, though. I think in 20 years' time, we're going to be talking about the shirts from the early 2000s and 2010s. So it's really a kind of moment in time right now. But I think it's a combination of those things. And then certainly within the community I'm in, if you look at, I think, the owners of Classic Football Shirts in Manchester and London, they're around my age as well. So, yeah, there's definitely an element of kind of people of my generation being nostalgic for the youth. And those are the products that are kind of fashionable at the moment.
Are there individuals, John, who are professional shirt traders, if you like, who can make a living out of seeking, sourcing and selling individual shirts?
Yeah, there's a significant number of them. There's the large ones in the UK of Classic Football Shirts, Cult Kits. Even in America, where I am, that's really starting to kick off. Saturday's Football is the big one out there, with shops in New York and LA. And they're making a considerable amount of money from it. I think the industry is probably in the 100 million range, maybe a little bit higher. And then obviously you have kind of secondary sellers and buyers that are using apps like eBay and Depop and Grailed to trade pieces as well. So there's varying sizes of sellers, I would say, but there's definitely people at all levels that are making a career out of vintage shirts.
It will come as no surprise, John, to our listeners that we are going to talk about football shirts for most of the rest of this interview. But we are a football finance pod, so we have to make a nod towards the money involved. How much is the industry worth globally, do you know? And can I ask how much you spend? Do you set a limit when you go after a particular shirt?
Yeah, it's a really hard question to answer on the first one, because there's no transparency. As far as I'm aware, none of these are public companies. They're not producing quarterly results that we're able to see and look at. I do have it on fairly good authority. One of the big ones is kind of turning over 20 million a year in revenue. And so that gives you an indication of if one of them's doing that, then there's several that are at that size and scale that can probably produce similar results. And so I personally think it's in the hundreds of millions. I am talking secondary shirts. Obviously, if you're thinking about Adidas and Nike launching first shirts and brand new kits, that's a different animal entirely in terms of the size. But for secondary, I think it probably is in the hundreds of millions. In terms of I don't really budget. The way that I kind of approach it is I have a list that I'm kind of tracking and trying to find and going after, either to complete a collection or for a project that I'm working on. And so there's generally 10 or so shirts on that list at any one time that I keep an eye on. I try and track. And if I can find them, I generally buy them, because the reality is they might only come up once a year or once every 2 years. And so you have to move fairly quickly if you're going to secure it. I would say, just to give you some context, probably the most expensive shirt I bought is about £500 for the Inter Milan 97-98 third shirt, the Ronaldo, Brazilian Ronaldo UEFA Cup winning shirt. So that was a big one that I finally managed to track down.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing because I can see Kieran, and I saw his eyes light up when you mentioned the combination of the words Inter Milan and third shirt. Kieran, I'm going to bring you in briefly on this question, because do you have any insight into what the replica shirt trade is worth on a global basis?
It's not. I mean, I've got the accounts of Classic Football Shirts in front of me, because
of course you have.
As well as collecting football shirts, I collect the accounts of football shirts companies. much of the joy of my wife. It's difficult. I mean, I think, as John was saying, it's a growing market, but it's very much a micro market where you've got individual sellers. My friend Phil, who runs oldfootballshirts.com, he has about two rooms devoted to football shirts, and an incredibly understanding wife. And there is certainly money to be made, but for him, it's a labor of love. You don't do it for the money. You do it for the reason why we collect all these types of things, because we've got a genuine affection for them.
Kieran, you've opened up the possibility of a new collectible here, replica accounts. Do you think we should be looking at that? You could be selling the Adidas 1972 rare account collection.
Get a pristine copy. I'd put that in shrink wrap and keep it for ages.
You mentioned, John, that there's a growing market in the US. Is that the biggest market globally for the replica shirts?
Certainly growing. I think Asia obviously plays a key role here as well. The Premier League is huge in Asia, as we know, and so that's definitely part of it. But yeah, I mean, I'm seeing it firsthand in America. Again, the shops in LA, the shops in New York, the secondary market of shirts being traded, and you know, my kids are really active in the soccer scene out there. You go to games and you see all these kits from around the world, parents wearing them and kids wearing them, and so it's definitely growing. NBC's played a big part in that in terms of live Premier League games on every weekend, five or six games, which really kind of helps because the competition is so fierce there with baseball and basketball and American football. But it is certainly becoming more prominent.
So would baseball shirts, would NFL shirts, would they be just as collectible replica shirts for those sports?
As far as I'm aware, I mean, the NFL shirts, it's interesting because the Premier League's kind of going this way as well. The authentic NFL shirts are really quite expensive in the kind of 200-300 range for a specced up player version. And I think we're getting there with Premier League shirts as well. I think there's a market. I mean, America's a big collective market, whether it's Air Jordan originals or where it's the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls shirts. There's always appetite for those type of historically important items. So those would certainly kind of trade in a similar fashion to these vintage shirts.
This is almost an intangible question, John, and much of your book is dedicated to trying to answer it. But what makes a particular shirt collectible? Why are some shirts more desirable and therefore expensive than others? I mean, I've got a few Palace shirts in the '90s. I reckon I'd probably get £3 for a couple of them. Kieran's probably got a Brighton Nobbo shirt. She might get £2 because it's got the word knob on it. But you know. Why does a shirt suddenly stick out? Because it's and would I be right in saying that continental shirts seem to be more desirable than English shirts?
Yeah, so firstly, I'd happily pay you £3 for a Crystal Palace early 90s shirt. So that's that's going to be in the hundreds probably. But that's really the genesis of the book in terms of why I wrote it. I was curious on that exact question. Out of the thousands of kits that are produced every year, why do some of them go on to be worth hundreds and some of them go on to be worth nothing? And so I think there's a little bit of a misconception that people really focus on design. It has to be a great design kit. I didn't really fully buy into that. And maybe just to give you an example of that, the Leicester City Premier League winning shirt, it's not the most attractive shirt. It's a Puma template. It's fairly standard, but that one's really hard to get hold of. You're talking £300-400 if you can find it. It's only 8 years, eight, 9 years ago in terms of when that shirt's from. And so for me, there's more to it. It's the design. Has there been success with the shirt? Is there player association with a Messi or a Maradona or whoever it might be? Controversy is another big one. The Zidane 2006, his last game where he gets sent off for the headbutt. That, again, that's a really expensive shirt, even though it's a templated away shirt. So there's a lot that kind of goes into it. And then the other thing that I apply quite a lot of weight to is the size of the watching public. And so these companies that produce the lists of the top 10 most expensive shirts of all time, it's no coincidence that it's the Barcelonas, the Napolis, the Holland, the Germanys. Big nations, big clubs with a lot of viewers that are kind of watching the games. They're creating the same nostalgia for the same moments. And that really kind of drives up the demand side of the equation. And then it comes down to supply in terms of how many of those shirts are still available. What condition are they in? Can you source them? And so that's really, for me, what kind of drives the price point. In terms of what's desirable, I mean, Premier League in this country, there's definitely a market for it. But again, I always think about the distribution at the time, and it goes without saying there were more Premier League kits distributed in the UK than anywhere else. And so there's more supply. And so, yeah, if you're trying to find Italian shirts or J-League shirts from Japan, those are going to be more expensive because they weren't produced here, and you're going to have to try and source them from overseas. So that plays a factor as well. But yeah, it's interesting as an asset. If you think of the shirts, you probably paid £30 to £40 in the mid-90s for these kits. Now you're paying £400-500 for them. I mean, that's a pretty big kind of markup. And so it shows the trajectory of some of them, certainly not all of them. And that's where I think the design isn't the full story, because there's some amazing kits out there where the team's been relegated or something's happened and the shirts are worth £20-30, even though they're 30 or 40 years old. And so there's certainly more to it than just the design.
Yeah, I didn't concentrate fully during that answer because I'm still thinking about the fact that one of my Palace shirts in the 90s might be worth £100 because I love my club, but if I'm sitting on a grand's worth of shirt up there, I don't love my club that much. Are there, John, do people specialise? So will you get people who only collect Juve shirts or only collect Scotland shirts from 1995?
Yeah, that's another, I mean, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and so everyone has their own version of what's a key shirt or a Holy Grail shirt. And so you've got people that collect every Champions League winning shirt. You've got people that collect, they want every Premier League, every team that's played in the Premier League over the last 40 years. You've got people that are collecting international shirts. And so there's different kind of variety and variation within that. It is a hobby where I think you do have to have a bit of discipline, or otherwise you can just be consumed by every shirt that comes out and really kind of expand the collection that way. So it is worth having a little bit of discipline and adding some guardrails in terms of what you're going to go after.
I'll tell you, a football fan, John, who had no discipline at all. I travelled from Oslo to Liverpool doing Match of the Day 2 with a group of outrageously drunk Norwegian Liverpool fans who managed to get barred from the pub at 11 o'clock on Saturday morning, which took some doing as it didn't open until 11 o'clock on Saturday morning. but after we were waiting to interview them afterwards, and it took a while because one of them was in the club shop. Because they got so drunk that every game they went to, and he went to every game, so he would buy a replica shirt and have the score printed on the back so he would remember.
Wow.
I know. So I can't imagine they'd be worth much money. Before I ask about your Holy Grail, John, I think one thing I should have probably done this earlier. We should talk about, there's a difference presumably between people who collect replica shirts and those people who only collect actual shirts worn by players in specific games, which I presume the latter are much worth much more money, are they?
Yeah, that's a good point. So, I mean, I think of it in terms of a pyramid. And so the top of the pyramid is a match-worn shirt. And we've really seen the kind of top of that with the Maradona £7 million 1986 shirt. So that's really the peak. I don't think any of us would be surprised in a few years if Messi's World Cup winning shirt from a few years ago reaches certainly into the millions, maybe not that level. But yeah, so you've got match-worn, then you've got match-prepared. So these are the shirts that are given to the players in the changing room. Sometimes they get worn, they wear a different shirt per half. Other times they don't. Those tend to be given to officials or swapped with other players or auctioned off for charity. You then get down into the authentic version. So this is the same shirt the player is wearing in terms of the spec and thinner material, much more detailing. Those are the ones you're starting to see now in the shops, pretty high price tag, maybe 120 to 150, depending on the patches and the name sets and what you're putting on it. And then you get down into the official kind of stadium replica, they call it. So this is the shirt the fan would generally wear. A little bit more forgiving on the sizing. It's obviously meant for the fan and the fan on the stand rather than the guy on the wing. And then you get down into kind of official remakes and then remake. And then kind of the bottom of the pile is the fake that you can buy maybe for kind of £10 or so. So there is a hierarchy. There's certainly people that specialize in the match worn. We're actually starting to see some technology innovation around that, where there's apps where you can bid on shirts during a game. So for players having a particularly good game, you can bid on that shirt through an auction. Again, it's going in the hundreds, the thousands for those shirts. You can win those, win being an interesting term. You can buy those. And then obviously the match prepared certainly has some value as well. And that's where it's interesting, because people are operating at different levels of the market. And even when I'm talking about replicas going for £400 or £500, those are the shirts you could have bought in the shop in the mid-90s. Obviously, match worn is going to be a much higher premium.
Yes, my ambition is to buy a shirt that was actually worn by Eric Cantona. I'd pay a lot of money for that, and then I'd lose all that money by burning it in the centre circle at Sellers Park. But it's interesting you say that, the match-worn thing though, John, because increasingly, like Palace, for example, after every home game are selling at least one match-worn shirt, or auctioning at least one match-worn shirt to raise money for the foundation that I'm part of. So will that affect the value in years to come, because these shirts are becoming more available than they would have been perhaps 10 years ago?
Yeah, I definitely think there's a supply element now. If you think of the big clubs that are producing millions of shirts, and so millions of anything, how valuable is it really going to be? And so there is an element of that. I do think they produce, it depends on the club size, but they're producing third and fourth kits in maybe smaller quantities. If you buy the right size, you keep it in the wrapping, you keep the label on it, you get it fully specced up with the players and the patches, maybe there's an argument to say those are going to increase in value. But I think it is becoming a bit harder. I wonder about the clubs in terms of, it's a bit of an untapped revenue stream for them. And Kieran might know more about this than me, but why are they not auctioning off these shirts after the game? If you've got Harry Kane's shirt and he's just scored a hat trick, you feel like they're missing a trick a little bit to auction those shirts off and maybe kind of bolster the revenue of the club by tapping into this market that's out there. So that might be something that we see in the future as well.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Well, I'll bring you in, Kieran. Why? That's a very good question from John. Why? Because clearly, Spurs would make a fortune if they auctioned off every shirt that was worn at the end of every game. There's going to be plenty. I mean, the Son Min-hyung shirts are going to go for an incredible amount of money, you'd imagine, just them alone.
Yeah, I think we get into a slightly deeper position here. Who does that shirt belong to?
Okay.
Because it's the player's shirt. I know of one match where a club tried to, it was a famous victory for the club. They sold all of the match day shirts because the club was in financial distress, but one of the players refused and sold it off on eBay himself. So, you know, you do see that. It does start to get more complicated, but I agree entirely with John. If you've just won an FA Cup final or a playoff match, you would want, but football players are fans of football as well, and they want those mementos as from parts of their career. Do they want a shirt from every match? No. There is huge demand from charities, from organisations to interact with clubs, and it is a balancing act. I think the concern, especially at Premier League level, is that if you are seen to be trying to rinse every single dime out of fans for every single match, the optics don't look particularly good, but if the value of these shirts is going to continue to increase, and you could be making, if you could sell each shirt for $5,000, you've got 18 players, that's almost $100,000 per match. You do that over a season, that's £2 million. Well, that pays for the extra distribution from the Premier League to the EFL.
Well, actually, now you've mentioned it, talking of rinsing every dime, we're going to be talking about the New England shirt later on. But it's just occurred to me, John, and again, this is why I love doing interviews about kits, because I've got my questions written down and then the questions that keep flooding into my half-empty mind. So the England game the other night, we saw against Belgium with their splendid tinting kit. But in the second half, England, in that less than splendid grey kit, but in the second half, the England players, to remind people about Alzheimer's and what a dreadful disease it is and how people's memories go, they wore shirts in the second half with no names on the back. It just makes me wonder, would that make them more collectible or less collectible?
Yeah, definitely more collectible. Any variation on a shirt that deviates from the standard that's been issued to the fans and the public tend to increase in value. We've seen it other campaigns with Arsenal whiteout shirt to prevent or kind of raise awareness around knife crime in London. Those are selling for significant amounts. They were obviously produced in limited quantities. They were auctioned off for charity. And so if you can get hold of those carry a premium. So yeah, certainly any kind of variation from the original will increase in price.
Right, finally, I'll get onto the Holy Grail question. What's your current favourite kit, the one you have in your collection, and what's the Holy Grail for you? What's the one shirt you would actually sell the house for?
Yeah, it changes over time. There's kits that I'm going after. I'm trying to get hold of the Parma 98 to 99. They had 8 shirts that season when they won the UEFA Cup, and so those are hard to come by. So that's currently on the list. It's hard to pick one. I love the Mexico Aztec shirt with the big print from 1998. The Italian kits from the 90s with Juventus and the Sony mini disc. I do like the sponsors that are no longer there. So mini disc obviously being kind of one of those that's kind of appealing. The kit that hangs over everyone's head when you start collecting is the Holland 88. So it's kind of regarded as the the key shirt that really brought in a new wave of design. And so that one is generally in the £800 to £1,000 range just for the replica that was in the, that was available in the shops at the time. So, I mean, at some point, if I can find it at a good price and the right size, I might pull the trigger on that one. But yeah, the focus right now is on Parma.
It has to be the right size. Then you have to be able to wear it. Is that part of the?
Yeah, I don't, and I'm going to upset a few people probably by saying this. I don't actually wear them. I mean, occasionally if I'm going to a game, I might wear one, but I don't. Yeah, I don't wear the old ones just because, again, they're worth a lot of money, and you don't want to damage them or ruin them. So it's not really that purpose, but it's more about the resale. Obviously, kid sizes don't really kind of cut it in terms of, you know, holding their value or increasing in value. So really, if you're looking at it in terms of holding its value or increasing, you want a medium, large, or maybe an XL. Those are probably your three ranges, and then anything outside of that, the price will kind of be a little bit lower.
Are there any particular current kits that you predict will become exceptionally collectible?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's interesting time, and obviously speaking to you, the Euro kits have all been announced. There's some amazing ones there. I love the Adidas Germany one with the flag down the long sleeve, which is beautiful. The Tintin kit, as you mentioned, with Belgium, are really good. If I think of recent years, you know, back to what I said earlier, it's not all about the design. It can be about success. If we think of Liverpool, they haven't won a Premier League for 30 years. They suddenly secure one. Who knows, Klopp leaves at the end of the season. It might be another 30 years before they win the next one. And so there's a generation of kids where those kits are going to be really prominent and important to them in 10, 15, 20 years' time. And so those could be valuable. And then there's just some great designs out there. I do think we're in a kind of golden period of designs where the manufacturers are really kind of pushing the envelope in terms of style and trying to incorporate elements of history and the authenticity of the club. So there's plenty out there of the Roma ones from recent years. The one that kind of caught my attention recently that I did actually buy was Inter Milan have got the Paramount Plus sponsor. And so they've been able to kind of change the sponsor for different games. And so they had the Ninja Turtles on the front of it a couple of weeks ago. They had the Transformers logo on it a couple of months ago. And so shirts like that, I think, that are used for one game, it's a one-off limited supply. I think those are probably ones to kind of keep an eye on as well.
And as this is Germany's last Adidas kit, John, presumably that will add value to it as a collector's item in the future as well, will it?
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I do find that quite an interesting decision. There tends to be a bit of kind of national bias on these big clubs and the manufacturers they choose. USA kits made by Nike, as an example, that's a long-standing relationship. And so Adidas moving away from that is quite significant, or Germany moving away from Adidas, whichever way it went. But yeah, there's certainly, they've produced some memorable kits. The Germany 1990 kit is a big one amongst collectors, with the flag across the front on the kind of diagonal. That's a big one. And so yeah, this one for the Euros is a great kit. And I could see that one has been one that kind of holds its value in years to come.
We spoke on the pod this week, John, about the Adidas deal closing with Germany, and we spoke at great length about the controversy about the cost of the New England kit. I'd be interested to hear from you as a collector, a trader, what you make of the price of current kits, and in particular that New England kit, which is, I mean, eye-wateringly expensive for most people.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the pricing is outrageous, particularly for the kids' kits. I find that a little bit hard to stomach. It's a little bit different if you're buying a shirt as a collector or a fan. I think the other thing people have to bear in mind is, are you buying it just to show support for the Euros? Because if you're buying it just as a collector's piece, wait 6 months, and if England get knocked out in the first round, then suddenly that shirt's worth £20. So it depends the reason you're buying it for. The other thing I would say is, for me, football shirts have always been expensive. I mean, it won't surprise you to know that in addition to football shirts, I've got a few old programs and things kicking around from the 90s, and the pricing's in there. The shirts, Aberdeen shirts, which was a close team to me, £37 in the early 90s. That was expensive at the time, right? That's probably a weekly food shop. And so if we think of inflation and the price now, then maybe it's comparable. But yeah, there's definitely been a divergence in recent years between the authentic and the stadium replica. And so to get a hold of an authentic version, the price has a premium, and unfortunately, you know, people are willing to pay it. And so that's why they're able to charge it. We might be reaching a period of where the price will start to plateau and it'll become a little bit more stable, but it doesn't feel like we're there yet.
Do you think, John, that kit manufacturers are starting to bear you lot in mind? And I say you lot because I don't know what the collective noun is for a shirt collector. But do you think kit manufacturers are starting to design shirts with a view to them being collectible in in 20, 30 years' time, because you see, I mean, even on the New England cut, the kit, that terrible grey one they wore the other night, even there, the detail down the inside, the side, the checks, is, you sort of think they're looking ahead. They're making these shirts, you know, not exclusive, but certainly more collectible than a plain white shirt would be.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a big part of it in terms of limited release, boxed editions. We're only going to wear it for one game. That creates, obviously, a sense of urgency amongst collectors. And then just the number of shirts. I mean, I think a few years ago, Napoli had 13 shirts in one season. So it's incredible just in terms of the numbers they're producing. And they're obviously targeting. That isn't for the fan in the stand. That's obviously going after collectors that have to have the full set. And, you know, they're really kind of targeting that audience. So we're definitely seeing more of that. I do feel a little bit sorry for the designers. They're obviously, you know, they're having to produce these kits en masse every single year. And what, certainly the home shirts, what can you do with a Man United or a Liverpool shirt to make it look different every season? So they're having to be creative and they're having to be a bit more kind of expressive in the design. And so, you know, that's kind of playing into it as well.
Yeah, I feel sorry for the designers of Palace shirts because they have to put up with Steve Parish being involved at every level. Steve Parish is like Kieran and I when we were kids, when you doodle kits at the back. Do replica shirts have to have the sponsor's name on them to retain their value?
Sponsor's name, yeah, I would say so. I mean, you really want as one as close to what the players are wearing as possible. I think the name sets is a big one. Certainly the data that I looked at and kind of went through in preparation for the book, it adds about 40% to the value of the shirt if you've got an official print set with a player on the back as opposed to just the plain shirt. And so that's definitely something. If you're buying to collect, I always, particularly the new shirts, I'd always get a name set on the back. And so, yeah, that's another part of it.
And how big an issue are fakes and forgeries?
It's a big issue. It's a really big issue. I mean, I remember in the 90s, you'd go on holiday to Italy or Spain, you'd buy a fake shirt for £7, €7. It was clearly a fake. I mean, it had five Adidas stripes on the sleeve. You could tell what was going on with it. Whereas now, unless you've got them side by side, it's pretty hard to tell in terms of what's the authentic and what's the fake. And so you have to be really careful. Again, I cover a little bit in the book in terms of look at the product codes and do your research online and make sure that you know what you're buying. But that's a real risk. I mean, like any commodity, if you're buying vintage wine or stamps or whatever it might be, you have to be able to authenticate it. And I do think as an industry, that is something that's missing. There's not an independent authentication service, which I think would help really add a little bit more trust to the kind of industry.
Mm. Penultimate question, John. In years to come, do you think women's kits will become just as collectible as men's kits are now?
Yeah, definitely. And I think we're already seeing that. And there's a great story, obviously, with the Women's World Cup and Mary Earps getting the goalkeeper shirt produced by Nike. But yeah, that's going to be a huge part of it. My daughter's really active in soccer, and so she wants to wear the Women's England kit. She wants to see the own version and they have their own heroes. They have their own nostalgia and their own moments. And so that's definitely a kind of a big part of it, I think, in terms of future opportunities for collecting.
So I love the world we live in here. You've got a Scotsman living in America whose daughter supports England.
I know. It's hard to convince a child to support Scotland when they fail to qualify for major tournaments for, you know, 20 years.
I think I know the answer to this last question, John. I hope I do. Will this last, or are we looking at a sort of polyester crypto scenario here where eventually people go, I'm not going to pay that much money for what is essentially a secondhand shirt?
Yeah, I do. I think that's a really good question, and it's a little hard to answer. But one thing I will say is the football as a global game continues to grow. It's hitting new markets. There's more interest, certainly in terms of wherever there's football, there's games, there's players, there's special moments, there's trophies. And with that, people are going to want to have a physical reminder of that moment. And so I think shirts as well as other memorabilia will continue to be attractive to people. And so I think overall, I'd have confidence in saying that this isn't a moment in time. I think it will be cyclical in terms of what's deemed fashionable and what's deemed attractive in terms of the specific shirts. But as a whole and as an industry, I think there's certainly more growth and opportunity to come.
John, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. We promised Guy we'd keep it to a manageable length, because otherwise, if we just start talking about individual shirts, we will be here all day. I can't recommend your book highly enough. I wish you every success with it. Do you think there'll be a second volume in the pipeline eventually?
Yeah, so actually, we just signed the contract with a publisher, so I'm working on the second one. Can't say too much about it, but it'll carry on a similar theme in terms of shirts.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us, John, and like I say, all the best.
Thanks so much for having me.
We deliberately kept it to about half an hour, Kieran, because we literally would be here all day talking about individual shirts, but there's so much of that I found fascinating. But in particular, Kira, your point about who owns the shirt, when we're talking about the market for match-worn shirts, that idea of there being some conflict between the ownership, whether the player owns it or whether the club owns it, is a really interesting one because, like as you said, there's a huge amount of potential earnings there for football clubs, isn't there?
That's right. The players will potentially want a memento. Remember, players often also swap shirts. But if I was the agent of a high-profile player and the club came and said, oh, by the way, we intend auctioning off the shirt of Harry Kane, Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi at the end of every match, I'd say, we need to have a conversation about this because you're getting the money effectively off the IP of my client. Surely he's entitled to a share as well. So it could result in further negotiations between agent, player and club if the players won't mind. If it's done for charity, for the club foundation once or twice a season, the players are great with regards to things like that. But if it is seen as a moneymaker for the club, well, why shouldn't it be a moneymaker for the player as well?
Mm. I've got more questions I want to ask you, Kieran, but I'm heading upstairs to put some Palace shirts on eBay. So thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod as well, it will get you access to our chat community and our regular quizzes. End of season quizzes approaching. You can do that by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com and you can go to the same website for our book or a Price of Football t-shirt. We'll be back on Monday with our regular questions pod. Have a lovely weekend. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
The Price of Football.
Picture this, the roar of a crowd, the tension building, the electrifying moment your team scores the winning goal. Pure joy, right? But for many football fans, barriers can shut them out of that experience. In the UK, nearly 1 in 4 people, that's 16 million, have a disability. And over 70% of those disabilities are non-visible.
There's a really broad range of non-visible disabilities out there. So it can be hearing loss, it can be sight loss, it can be neurodiversity, it can be any manner of things that people can't perceive.
People look, why are they parking in a blue badge space? They can walk. Why are they using an accessible toilet? They're walking in. But that's not the point. You can't see the invisibleness of the disability. But then if somebody's judging you, you can tell they haven't got the awareness. They haven't got the understanding.
I've always lived my life as a sighted person who can't see. To the point where then if I didn't have my long cane chance, a lot of people wouldn't know. Me having it isn't always just for me, but it is actually for other people as well.
Find out how you can contribute to a more inclusive matchday experience for everyone by supporting Level Playing Field, the national charity advocating for greater access and inclusion for all disabled sports fans through its Unite for Access campaign. Unite for your team, unite as a fan. Let's unite for access.